genes aren't just, you know, finished with their work when you're born. Genes are always actively building cells, building new molecules, building new enzymes. They're always working on our behalf based on the signals we give the genes. And sometimes we give the genes really good signals that build muscle, that burn fat, that support the immune system. But sometimes we give these genes the opposite of the intended effect. So we give these genes signals that cause us to become arthritic or to become diabetic or to put on extra fat and not be able to burn it or to get sick more often.
Welcome to the Disruption Zone. Opportunity lives where the status quo dies. Talking to the greatest innovators, disruptors, and off-the-wall inventors we can scrounge up. You laugh, you'll learn, you'll be inspired. Now, here are your hosts, Leland Conway and Cameron Mills.
It's the Disruption Zone. I'm Leland Conway. My partner in crime, Cameron Mills, is usually here with us, but he is out of town this week, so I am flying solo. Super excited about our guests for this week because this guy has changed, if not saved, my life. A few years ago, I had a medical situation where I had unbelievably high blood pressure. I was in the hospital for 3 days. And the doctors told me that I needed to eat less salt and basically eat a diet of like an 80-year-old person with lots of healthy grains. And something about this just didn't ring true for me. So I started looking into it. My dad actually got off of insulin through an Atkins-type diet, and I started researching that. And I came across this blog called Mark's Daily Apple. And this dude, Mark Sisson, who was backing up all of the stuff he said with science and talking about how our ancestors used to eat and didn't have a lot of the chronic illnesses that we have today. Well, Mark Sisson is a former major athlete. He's been in over 200 endurance athletic events. He's built a major company that sells health supplements and amazing food. And he has helped save a lot of people's lives by turning them around and helping them to recognize that carbs are part of what our problem is in today's standard American diet. And I want to welcome him to the show. Mark Sisson, thanks for coming on. How are you?
I'm great, Leland. Thanks for having me, man.
Super honored to talk to you because I'm not exaggerating when I say you may have saved my life. I know it's that I've had better quality of life than I ever thought was possible after being hospitalized a few years ago. And it really is because of the principles that you lay out in your book, The Primal Blueprint. I read that, and then I got the updated version, and now I got the keto version, and I've got all your stuff. But, you know, just talk to us a little bit about how you came to this, because you were an endurance athlete for years, and you pretty much followed the standard American diet paradigm until you had an epiphany. Tell us what happened.
Yeah, so, you know, I was always interested in fitness and health and performance and longevity and all those things. I started running in my teens, long distance because it was good for your heart, theoretically. I started eating, you know, a complex carbohydrate based diet because that's what everybody said you needed to do in order to provide fuel to run all those miles. Within a few years, I was quite fit. I was racing well. I was, putting great times up on the board and winning races. But I was starting to feel a little haggard and I was starting to break down on the inside. I had, osteoarthritis in my feet, tendonitis in my hips, irritable bowel syndrome, upper respiratory tract infections several times a year, heartburn. I mean, like here I am on the outside looking like I'm the fittest, one of the fittest dudes in the world. And on the inside, I'm almost, you know, killing myself. So I had to take a step back and understand what was going on and what I was doing wrong. Partly, I was just forced to do this because I got injured and I just couldn't keep the miles up, particularly with the arthritis. It just wasn't allowing the sort of training I wanted to do. So I rededicated my life to figuring out how I could be strong and lean and fit and healthy without, first of all, without having to put all those miles in. My goodness. And then also, if there was a way to do it through, you know, more dietary inputs and less relying on grinding it out in the gym. And so that kind of started a 35-year journey looking at ways in which our bodies use genetic expression to rebuild us, renew us, recreate us, regenerate us minute by minute, day by day, based on the inputs we give our genes. So genes aren't just, you know, finished with their work when you're born. Genes are always actively building cells, building new molecules, building new enzymes. They're always working on our behalf based on the signals we give the genes. And sometimes we give the genes really good signals that build muscle, that burn fat, that support the immune system. But sometimes we give these genes the opposite of the intended effect. So we give these genes signals that cause us to become arthritic or to become diabetic or to put on extra fat and not be able to burn it or to get sick more often. And so my journey has kind of led me to, and the reason I started Mark's Daily Apple was to take the learnings that I was getting from the research into these hidden genetic switches that we all have and putting that information out there in a way that people could understand. Like, oh, wait a minute, if I eat this certain way, you mean I'll learn how to burn fat and I won't become fatter? Or if I eat this certain way, you know, I'll build muscle. Or if I work out this certain way, you know, I'll become lean and strong and powerful. But if I work out another way, I'll become lean but skinny and more endurance-based. And so it's interesting. It was interesting to really see all these different behavioral inputs from certainly food and exercise too. Amount of sleep you get, the amount of sun exposure you get, the amount of play, the amount of social interaction, just the thoughts that you have throughout the course of the day. All of these are affecting how your genes rebuild you. And that's the magic and the empowerment of what we talk about with this thing I call the Primal Blueprint.
Well, and I think one of the things that really struck me when I first started reading your site, and you put it in, you have a knack for having the science to back it up, but putting it in terms that like a person who has no knowledge of this stuff can go, oh, that makes sense. But one of the things that stuck out to me, my family, I've got a lot of people in my family that have died from type 2 diabetes. It, quote unquote, runs in my family. And when I read a piece that you wrote on that where you were like, basically, yeah, there's some genetic tendencies that we have, but it's really up to you whether you unlock that genetic signal. When it made sense to me, like, wait a minute, I don't have to accept the fate of what supposedly runs in my family. Can you talk about that a little bit? Because I think one of the number one problems we have in health today is that people go, it runs in the family. And then they accept this awful fate, you know, where they're stuck riding around the mall on a scooter. It drives me up the wall.
I agree. And, you know, it's astute of you to recognize that. So basically, you know, we have a shared genetic recipe. All of us have genes that build muscle the same way, that burn fat the same way, that support the immune system the same way. It's just the degree to which we do these things that varies among individuals. So some of us may be a little bit more predisposed to adding muscle when we work out. Some of us might be a little bit more predisposed to getting a little bit of extra body fat if we overeat food. Some of us can get away with not doing that. But basically, we share this genetic recipe, and so to the extent that your parents and your grandparents might have had a predisposition to diabetes, for instance, in your case, doesn't mean they had to get it. In many cases, I would say it's a learned behavior. Like you learn to eat the foods that cause the genes to turn on a certain way. And your body, as I've said many times, people getting type 2 diabetes often isn't a result of defective genes. It's the result of really good genes that are just responding to the signals that you're giving them, but you're giving them way too much sugar and not enough exercise, and the genes go, well, oh, wait a minute, okay, if this is how we're going to live, then we have to respond this way. We actually have to create type 2 diabetes as a defense mechanism. We have to become insulin resistant because we're pumping up so much insulin. You know, it's kind of interesting that you would almost assume that you have this defect in your genes that causes you to get type 2 diabetes, but I could pretty much create type 2 diabetes in anybody in this country if I gave them a certain diet. By the way, the antithesis of that is I could pretty much cure type 2 diabetes if it's caught early on with anyone who has it in this country if they followed the rules for eating a different way. It's about the signals that you give your genes. So if we look at heart disease and a lot of people say, oh, you know, heart disease runs in my family. Well, you know, there is a familial predisposition, but it's not a death sentence. It's not mandated. Right. It just means that you have a red flag that requires that you pay a little bit more attention to your diet than somebody else who might be able to get away with certain proclivities.
It aggravates me that we're having a debate right now in Congress about the price of insulin, and no one is talking about why we need so much of it.
I know. It's really a classic, you know, if you've ever seen the movie Idiocracy, it's
yeah.
we're just headed right down that path. It's a wacky movie, right? And every time I see something, I read a headline like that, I'm like, okay, we're just that much closer to the predictions that Mike Judge gave us in Idiocracy.
Walk us through physiologically, because I think this is a key. Because I get, you know, and I talk to people about, you know, the dietary changes that I made. A lot of people kind of look at you in disbelief when you say this happened when I made these changes. Walk us through the physiological changes that will happen when you go from eating first of all, describe the standard American diet and the difference between that and the Primal Blueprint, but kind of walk us through the physiological changes people can expect when they switch to this style, this lifestyle of eating and living.
Well, first of all, the standard American diet these days, it's based on an abundance of carbohydrates, like 200, 250 to 400 to 500 to 600 grams of carbs a day, much of which is in the form of simple sugars, which are horrendous. It's based on the fats and oils that are included in this standard American diet coming from industrial seed oils like soybean oil, corn oil, canola oil, which are pervasive throughout all of the food chain that we tend to look and find in the center aisles of the store. Those oils are very highly inflammatory. So between the excess sugar, the excess processed industrial seed oils being inflammatory, and the excess calories, people just eat too much food in general. Those three things combined to have an effect on the system, which is basically the excess sugar prompts the body to respond by secreting insulin because sugar is toxic in excess in the body. In fact, in a healthy body at any one point in time, there's only 5 grams of sugar in the entire bloodstream.
Wow.
Now, if you think 5 grams of glucose or 5 grams of sugar, and you're consuming 350 or 400 grams a day, you can imagine, you know, that if sugar is toxic, what the body's trying to do to get rid of it. And so it secretes insulin, and insulin then, which is a nutrient storage hormone, it unlocks pathways into the cell, presumably to get rid of glucose and send the glucose into muscle cells, hopefully. But if the muscle cells are full, because muscle cells store glucose in the form of glycogen, then it sends them to the fat cells. And so the fat cells are like, yeah, come on in, we love more. You know, and so, and then that excess fat, excess triglycerides, they get absorbed in the cells. And the next thing you know, you've got somebody who's gaining, you know, a pound, 2 pounds, 5 pounds a year. And that's, you're gaining weight partly because the body's trying to dispose of this excess carbohydrate, this excess glucose that you've given it. Then we have a situation where we're taking in these industrial seed oils, these highly inflammatory processed Franken oils, Franken fats like corn oil, soybean oil, canola oil, and
basically,
they have a very deleterious.
Basically, everything our fast food is fried in.
Yeah, and by the way, also some of our supposedly healthy salad dressings contain a lot of these oils.
Yeah.
And so I watch people every day take a wonderful mix of, you know, leafy greens and colorful vegetables, and then destroy it with a salad dressing that's got canola or soybean oil in it.
I was at the store. I was at the store last week, and I was like, I normally use your dressings. Plug for Primal Kitchen because they're delicious. But I was out and I was looking for yours, and the store was out of yours, and so I just started looking at some of the other dressings. One was called olive oil and vinegar, and I thought, well, that's probably olive oil, right? I turned the ingredients around. No, it's the first ingredient is canola oil. And I'm like, okay, look, I'll pay you an extra couple bucks. Why do you have to put canola oil in it?
Yeah, or why do you have to put on the label olive oil just because it contains a little bit of olive oil?
Right.
You know, but that's what big food has been doing that for a long time.
Yeah. Is there,
blame game.
when we say big food, I mean, can we talk about that for a minute? Because I want to kind of get back to the physiological effects, but I think this is important too. I've heard you say before, and others in this world talk about how essentially 90% of what's for sale in a grocery store, we should never put in our bodies.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, processed food. Look, we are wired to overeat. We are wired to consume sweet things. We are wired to love crunchy, salty, fatty, sweet. And so companies, going back 100 years before they knew about the health effects of these things, basically were catering to the desires of the public. And so when you make a crunchy, salty, fatty, sweet snack, whether it's a, you know, a chip, or whether it's a type of bread, or whether it's a cereal, a breakfast cereal, or whatever, and it appeals to people's taste buds and their sensibilities that way, people vote with their dollars. And so over the years, we got used to buying these less than ideal non-food substances, these processed foods. And we got away from eating natural, you know, vegetables and fruits and grass-fed animals and naturally raised animals, and we started, you know, eating these types of foods that were not only appealing to our taste buds, but were relatively inexpensive.
Right.
And so we went down this very slippery slope where we got sicker and fatter. And
yeah.
And it's only in the last couple of decades that we started to really recognize how insidious that whole system has been, and how we got sort of tapped into it, and now we're like literally we're hooked on that.
Yeah.
Right, and people are addicted to the same types of foods that are killing them, and then you know it's tough to get off of.
Right,
right. It's tough to find a replacement.
Well, going back to what you were saying earlier too, I think we're also addicted to this false concept that we need three meals a day. I haven't eaten since 9 o'clock last night. It's 12:30 now. I'm not even hungry, Mark. I'll eat probably around 3 this afternoon, and that's natural. It's not like I'm trying to. It's just I just don't need it anymore. But what I have today will be incredibly nutritious. It'll be whole foods. Can we, like, okay, for people that are new to this, because this is I really want to drive this point home for people who are listening going, I'm skeptical. Why are grains bad for us?
Well, so, you know, grains, like a lot of foods, they sort of exist on a spectrum, and there are some grains that are benign, that aren't that bad for you, that are, you know, maybe they taste okay if you put something on them. Then there are grains that are, have been, you know, adulterated over the years, over the generations, and are probably quite bad for you. I mean, gluten, wheat gluten is probably the most commonly referred to one, and certainly one that was the epiphany that I had, was that once I cleaned up my diet, you know, I really got the final piece of the puzzle when I gave up grains. For me, I realized I had assumed grains were good for me because I read it.
Right.
I'd assumed that grains were good for me because I liked, you know, I liked whole grain breads and muffins and all of that stuff. But once I gave up grains and my arthritis cleared up immediately and my skin got better and my gastroesophageal reflux, my heartburn went away, that's when I realized, man, there's something going on here with grains. So when you say, why are grains bad for you? Well, look, some of the world would starve to death if they didn't have grains. So I can't just give it a good and evil, a black and white kind of assessment. But what I can say is that for a lot of people, grains are problematic. They might cause leaky gut syndrome, which can lead to autoimmune diseases. They might just cause mild inflammation, systemic in the bloodstream, or they might localize, you know, in the joints. For some people, grains are just another source of carbohydrate calories that they don't really need. That, look, when I come down to the essence of what grains are, it's basically kind of bland, beige glop that needs something on it to taste good anyway. I mean, whose favorite meal is a plain bowl of spaghetti with nothing on it, no butter, no oil, no sauce? So when you break it down and you look at, you know, the whole thing, like, what if I gave up grains, I would be giving up what might be problematic in terms of my digestive tract. I'm giving up a huge source of cheap carbohydrates that convert to glucose pretty quickly in my bloodstream, and I don't want that. I'm giving up calories that I don't need that I could certainly get not only from other sources, but from tastier sources. I think one of the things that you didn't mention, and I hope it's true, is that when you do have your meal, your nutritious meal at 3 o'clock or whatever, it'll be delicious. Yeah. It won't just be, oh my God, hold my nose and choke down this green drink. You know, there's probably 1,000 cookbooks, maybe 2,000, who knows, on paleo and keto and primal recipes. And every one of those cookbooks, if you took a meal out of that and you had a dinner party and you served it to guests who didn't know what was going on, invariably they would say, oh my God, it's one of the best you know, chicken dishes I've ever had. It's one of the best meat dishes I've ever had. It's one of the best egg dishes I've ever had. So it's not like you're making a sacrifice eating this way. You're actually availing yourself of some much more delectable treats if you have the means to, you know, prepare them or find them in a restaurant that happens to be fixing them that way or whatever. I mean, that's the biggest challenge for a lot of people, is knowing that there are some pretty tasty options out there, but, you know, not feeling compelled to spend a lot of time in the kitchen.
My wife got me your Keto Reset cookbook for Christmas, and thanks to that, there's nothing I eat that I think, God, that tastes bad. I don't eat anything that tastes bad. You know, I
mean, well, that's my rule. That's my number one rule. Because people go, oh, geez, Mark, you know, you know, look at you. You've been doing this for so long, and you must have an incredible amount of discipline to, you know, to not eat Cinnabon and to not eat. I'm like, no, I eat only things that give me pleasure. I want every bite of food I put in my mouth to taste awesome.
Right.
And I don't choke down anything that's supposed to be good for me just because you say it's good for me. So with those two rules, I enjoy every bite of food I eat.
So you cured arthritis with this. You cured irritable bowel syndrome with this. We can cure, for the most part, diabetes with this. How does that work? Because I think a lot of people are like, really? I mean, my dad was going to be on insulin, and he found a version of this diet, and he took his blood sugar from the 300s down to like upper 90s. I mean, and he did that by just dropping carbs, not eating sugar, and not eating bread. So, I mean, there's a litany of the chronic diseases that are driving our healthcare costs in America right now that literally could just go away if people made different food choices, right?
I've said this before. I mean, you know, if people ate the way we talk about, whether it's paleo or primal or keto, some version of that, basically it's real food. If they ate real food instead of processed food, and they watched their intake, and they watched when they were hungry and didn't eat, you know, just because it was time to eat, but because they were hungry and it was time to eat in that regard. If they did that, we could knock $1 trillion off the annual health bill within 18 months.
Oh my gosh.
Because 80% of what happens in emergency rooms and hospitals is related to diet and lack of exercise.
Yeah.
And by exercise, I'm not talking about running marathons. I'm talking about walking. I'm talking about getting out and moving. I'm talking about just walking and just doing push-ups once in a while. It gets you 80% of what you would need to reaccess good health. Now, if you want to look like, you know, a cover of a magazine, then you got a little bit of extra work to do. But if we're talking about just reaccessing good health, it's not that difficult. It's certainly not rocket science, and it's certainly available to just about everyone.
What is the ancestral connection? Because one of the things that really appealed to me when I started looking at your stuff was the tie-in to the fact that, like, look, up until 10,000 years ago, this is what we did, and we can't find evidence of diabetes, osteoporosis, bone density problems, digestive issues, rotten teeth, prior to the advent of agriculture.
Yeah. I mean, we were hunter-gatherers for most of our existence. Some would say it's a little bit over 2.5 million years now that we've been hominids, that we've been upright humans that have been, you know, tool making and hunting and gathering. Some would say that it's that our larger brains are a result of access to higher fatty foods and animal foods, first as scavengers and then as hunters. Now there's a recent paper just came out that looks at the scavenging thing a little bit deeper and looks at first tool use being hammers to crack open bones to get at marrow, which is a source of rich fats. It's all really, really interesting stuff. But the point is, evolution proceeds at a very slow pace. And in terms of human evolution, not much has changed in the last 10,000 years. So we are basically hunter-gatherers in pinstripe suits now. We're basically carrying around the same genes that evolved over a crucible of 2.5 million years of harsh conditions, minimal food supply, not knowing, you know, where the next meal was going to come from, being chased by wild animals that are looking to kill you all the time, harsh weather conditions. All these things are what forged a recipe that we each have that allows us to not only survive but thrive if we give it the right input. And so we looked at human evolution for those inputs. We go, okay, if our genes expect certain inputs to be optimized, what are those inputs? And if we look at human evolution, it's, well, okay, so humans moved around a lot. They didn't sit in sofas. They didn't sit in chairs and were inactive all day. They were actually active all day. So let's move around a lot. That'll give our genes the proper signal. Ancient humans did work. They lifted heavy things. So one of my primal blueprint laws is, guess what? Lift heavy things. Not every day, but once or twice a week. Go to the gym. Do a workout. If you can't go to a gym, do some body weight exercises in your house. Hunter-gatherers ate plants and animals. They didn't eat processed foods. They didn't eat Twinkies and Ho-Hos and ding-dongs and everything else, that snow cones and, you know, all the stuff that we grew up in. They ate real food. So let's take that information and apply it to a modern lifestyle, understanding that we still have these hunter-gatherer genes that want us to give certain signals so that they manifest as stronger muscles, more powerful, burning fat more easily, relying on fat for energy all day long, as opposed to relying on having to eat a snack with carbs in it every 2 to 3 hours. All of this comes from evolution. And now, in the last 10 years, it's all been proven by genetic science. So every time they do a study now, particularly a study on a nutrition study, they look at what happens at the level of gene expression. They see what genes are turning on or off based on the types of food that are being studied or the movement patterns that are being studied. I mean, everything looks at gene expression.
Right.
It's really cool that it's being validated that way. And, you know, there's a point at which you have to, you can take a step back and say, well, we don't have to look at evolution anymore because we have all these, you know, we have enough knowledge base now to sort of extrapolate. But it was kind of cool to look at history, to look at evolution and say, okay, you know, our ancient hunter-gatherer ancestors, you know, they were out in the sun all day. They didn't put on a lot of sunscreen, because they didn't have any. You know, they made vitamin D. Vitamin D is important. It's such an important vitamin, it actually should be a hormone. But it's integral in your immune system. And so they had healthy immune systems. Now, today, we avoid the sun because we're told that it's going to age us prematurely and give us skin cancer. And the irony there is that probably more people have cancer now because they avoid the sun.
Right.
And don't produce vitamin C than if they spend a little bit of time out in the sun every day.
Well, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. And then sleep. You know, sleep is enough. You know, our ancestors went to bed when the sun went down or shortly thereafter. And if they had a campfire, they were looking at an orange, yellow light in advance of going to sleep. Now we stay up late. We're looking at a blue screen, blue light, which delays the onset of melatonin, which is the sleep hormone. So now we sacrifice sleep because we think, well, I'll sleep when I'm dead, right?
Right.
And the irony there is, you know, you might die a little bit. You might get your wish a little bit.
Yeah, a little bit sooner than you thought. One of the generic arguments, though, is like, well, the lifespan was really short back then, so why are we basing diet on that? But that's kind of a lack of context on history, isn't it?
For sure. I mean, look, if a third of children died in childbirth or within the first year of infancy because they got mauled by a lion or whatever, if you're so susceptible to you know, being taken down because you jumped off a ledge and broke a leg and were no longer able to run away from an animal or run toward an animal to kill, you know, you kind of skew the averages downward. But by the same token, people lived into their 80s and 90s if they survived, you know, all of the traumatic things that were you know, kind of obstacles every day in your life a million years ago or 50,000 years ago, which are no longer obstacles at all. I mean, we have,
right.
You know, we don't face life-threatening situations every single day today the way our ancestors did. So that's the main reason that the sort of average lifespan was what it was. But people were certainly, they've had, anthropological studies look at some of these ancient societies and realize that, yeah, they could have lived to 85 or 90. That was probably the lifespan, even 50,000 years ago or 100,000 years ago.
Well, and let's say the average lifespan was 40 years at that time. Now the lifespan of health is about 40 years. I'm seeing people in their early to mid 40s. That's when the misery sets in our society today.
Well, not only that, here's the sad part is that, our health, well, they call it a healthcare system. It's actually a sick care system, but our sick care system, is, you know, sort of designed to reward bad choices. I hate to put it that way, but the fact that, you know, instead of a doctor saying, look, damn it, you know, you've got diabetes, you have to change your eating. You have to start exercising appropriately, not a lot, but appropriately. But instead what they say is, all right, take this prescription and you won't have to give up your favorite dessert. You can keep living your life, you know, and so the person lives longer, but they're a little bit more miserable, and maybe they lose a limb when they're 65 because of the, the lack of circulation in the extremities because of the diabetes, or they lose their eyesight. And it's a slippery slope, and and yet we tend to reward bad decisions with drugs that take the pain away.
I heard a stat yesterday that 75% of the time that if somebody asks for a drug they saw in an advertisement, their doctor will give them the pill.
Well, you know why? Because some of the new medical reform looks at ratings. How do you rate your doctor on a scale of 1 to 4? And even though if the doctor could be the best doctor in the world, and if he said, nope, I'm not giving you the meds because there's a better way to do this.
Right.
And you go, damn it, I want the meds. I'm giving you a 1. Right.
So like, right. Right.
So it's like you can't win that game.
Yeah.
As a doctor.
And I have a friend who I was trying to explain to them why statins can be bad. And why we have the wrong reading on cholesterol. Can you kind of explain the difference between why cholesterol isn't necessarily going to kill you? And then maybe why some drugs are probably good to stay away from if you can help it.
Well, so first of all, cholesterol is a very critical, molecule in the human body. It's essential for life. We need it for, some hormone production. We need it. They talk about vitamin D. It's, cholesterol is integral in the production of vitamin D. Every cell membrane has cholesterol. Cholesterol is a significant component of the brain. So we need cholesterol. We need it so much. In fact, the body makes about 1,300 to 1,400 milligrams a day, whether or not we take in dietary cholesterol. So cholesterol is not the culprit here. The culprit, it turns out, are two things, oxidation and inflammation. So the inflammation I talked about earlier, if you've got an inflammatory response, an immune system response going on in your body, combined with oxidation, the oxidation of the cholesterol, you get, and it's a very complex equation and probably a whole show in and of itself to talk about it. But basically, the proximate cause of heart disease is not cholesterol or high cholesterol, it's oxidation and inflammation. And yes, they see that cholesterol is a component of that, because when you've insulted the body, when you've got some insult on the interior lining of the artery and it's become inflamed and then irritated, and then the body mounts a response to it, which includes using cholesterol to lay down a plaque band-aid, basically. And then if you get that plaque and that thing going on and it gets too big, and it breaks off, and it can cause problems. But so it's not the cholesterol that's the issue. It's the inflammation. It's the oxidation. Those are things that are very controllable with the way you eat and the way you exercise.
So somebody
and controlling stress.
Somebody listening.
You don't need. Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, if somebody was listening right now and their doctor just said, "I need to put you on a statin because your cholesterol is high," before you do that, change your diet first and see what happens.
For sure. That is definitely something that I would do initially. And I'm not, you know, because I'm not a doctor and I can't give medical advice,
right?
You know, I would always say, find a simpatico doctor, find a doctor who understands ancestral medicine, and then have that discussion. Because for the most part, most physicians today don't have that point of view. They don't have that background, and they're, you know, God bless them. They went to medical school and they learned what they learned, and now they get a lot of their information from drug companies. And so the latest drug studies are what they rely on more than you know, some random blogger out on the internet.
Right.
But the reality is that I have said this, I said it 15 years ago, I'll say it again today. I think the statin drugs are the single greatest hoax ever perpetrated on the American public. And I won't leave it at that, but that's, you know, the number of people that I've encountered who've had bad experiences on statins, whether it's loss of energy, weakness in the muscles, you know, sort of a flakiness in terms of their cognition, general malaise, and probably didn't need to take the statins in the first place. You know, it's an alarming number. So, yeah. You know, anybody who's on statins, I'm not going to tell you to get off them. I'm going to just say, you know, do a little bit of research and share your desire to do what you can to get yourself off them. Share that desire with your doctor and figure out what that looks like.
All right. I know we're running out of time, but there's a couple other things I just wanted to hit real quick. If you could walk people through, you're 65, is that right? You look like maybe 40, if that. You look like you're in better shape than most 25-year-olds. I mean, you look amazing.
Thank you.
And this is possible. You know, we won't all be cover model magazine cover models, but it's possible for us to look and feel our best well into our 60s, 70s, and even 80s based on this. Can you walk us through like a daily routine / diet? Like, what do you eat normally? When do you eat? And what's your exercise regimen like?
So I get up 6:30 or 7, have a cup of coffee. I actually read physical newspapers now, so I read the New York Times. I usually do the puzzles. Doesn't take me long. I'm pretty good at the puzzles now. I do that for my brain. You know, then I go start writing. I write, and I answer emails. I do a bunch of stuff until probably 9:30 or 10, at which point I go do my workout. And I got a gym in the building that I live in, so it's easy for me now. Or I'll go for a paddle. I do stand-up paddling. I might do an hour and a half paddle. Then I'll come back, go back to work. Typically, and I often have podcasts or things like that throughout the day. So I don't eat until probably 1:30 myself as typically my first meal. Today, I'm probably going to have, you know, a Greek salad and some salmon, a nice piece of salmon, and that'll be my lunch. Then I'll come back and do a little bit more work. And then at probably, I don't know, 7:30, I'll have dinner, and dinner will consist of, again, another piece of, protein of some kind, maybe a ribeye steak, some grilled vegetables. My idea of vegetables is probably three times what a normal serving is.
Right.
Broccoli, Brussels sprouts, you know, things like that. And I might have a glass of wine, red wine. And then I'll, you know, I might watch a little TV. I mean, there's a, I don't know if we're in real time here, Leland, but there's a game on tonight, the national championship. So watch that.
We don't care in Kentucky since Kentucky's out, so we don't care anymore.
I know. I love the fact that people stop watching it all together when Kentucky's out. But, you know, and I, you know, do it again tomorrow. So I work out every day, and the main thing is I work out fasted. So I not only don't eat before a workout, I typically don't eat again for two or three hours after a workout. And I find that encourages this whole fat burning process, and you have to get used to it. But once you get used to it, you become a more efficient human being. You become what I call metabolically flexible.
Right.
And so you can derive energy from your own stored body fat all the time. And as you've experienced, the number one benefit of that is you don't get hungry.
Right.
So hunger doesn't run your life. And I have this happen quite often where it'll be 2:30 or 3:00 in the afternoon. I'm like, oh, I haven't eaten yet today. I hadn't felt like eating. I wasn't hungry, but I haven't eaten. Oh, you know what? I don't want to eat lunch now. I'm going to enjoy my dinner, so I'll just go straight through to dinner. So there are many days when I just have dinner. you know, I just might eat at 7 o'clock, and that's the one meal I have throughout the day.
But
again, it's not about willing myself to do that. It's about convenience and comfort and not needing to eat and not being angry and just being confident in my body's ability to extract energy from my stored body fat, from my glycogen, whatever. It's just and ketones, of course, if I've been eating really low carb, and all those things are legitimate energy sources that are so, they free you up. They free your life up from this otherwise being tethered to mealtime.
Yeah. Yeah. What is your total daily carb intake? And, you know, sometimes you might be in ketosis, which is going to be under 50, but on a normal, you know, when you're not trying to be in ketosis, what is your normal amount?
It's never over 200. It might be 150 some days. And it's not because I'm trying. It's just because I don't eat stuff that would accumulate to get me to a number that was 200 or more. And I said, I created this thing called the carbohydrate curve about 15 years ago, in which I kind of, I segmented different amounts of carbs, like 0 to 50 was keto, 50 to 100 was what I call the sweet spot for weight loss, and 100 to 150 was sort of maintenance, right? But I also made a statement that nobody needs more than 150 grams of carbs a day. Nobody, if you're metabolically flexible.
Yeah.
And I'm sticking with that statement. And so what I see is, you know, like most of the people in the United States, especially, you know, in areas like Kentucky, where people just don't have the information and are consuming 300, 350, 500, 600 grams of carbs a day.
Right. And then there's
that's the problem.
And there's that old paradigm where the trainer's always telling you, got to get your carbs. And I was,
oh my God.
Yeah, it drives me nuts. I was thinking about when you were talking there. I was like, you know, to me, I feel like there's two kinds of hunger. There's the kind of hunger that's driven by insulin reaction in your body, which is the got to get your carbs. And then there's the other kind, which is driven by your nutritional needs. The latter being far more comfortable. You know what I mean? I'm not uncomfortable when I get hungry. My body just says, hey, you know, throw me a piece of meat or something. Versus when
the body says, maybe it's time to eat.
Yeah.
Not like, oh my God, if I don't eat, I'm going to rip your head off.
Right, right, exactly. I know you love your ultimate frisbee on the weekends. You're 65 and you're keeping up with 20-year-olds. That's crazy. I've heard you talk about that before.
Had a big game last night. Played 2 hours in the heat, in the Miami heat. Fabulous game. I say fabulous because we won both games, but
it makes it more fabulous.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I do it for fun, but I am invested in the outcome, I have to say.
Yeah, well, competition, man. Yeah. Keeps us going. By the way, and this is kind of the last thing I wanted to cover with you, but I've admired your work ethic. Aside from the dietary stuff, you built the company. You were recently able to sell it to Heinz with the caveat that they had to keep everything whole and natural. You know, that inspires me. And I think what goes along with the idea of changing your diet and just changing your life is also the inspirational aspect of controlling your own destiny. Can you kind of give me a little bit about, like, because I admire what you've done with your life, and maybe there's an encouraging message to somebody out there. You know, this is a total package lifestyle change. This isn't just changing what you eat. It's changing how you live your life and how you pursue your goals.
Well, you know, how you do one thing is how you do another. You know, there are no accidents that way in life. I mean, so in my case, if I'm mindful about my eating, I'm mindful about my exercise. I'm also mindful about my productivity in business, and I'm mindful about how I interact with my family. And I know that term mindfulness is getting thrown around a lot these days, but there's something to it. It's just being in the moment and paying attention and being, you know, grounded and not being victimized by your own, you know, claim of ignorance because you don't know something or you don't have access to it, or, you know, again, you're doomed because of your parents and what the legacy they gave you. None of that is carved in stone. You know, it's really about, like I say, how you do one thing is how you do another. And if it starts with diet, if that's where you can get it together, that's probably the best place, because that starts to improve your outlook on life. You have more energy. You know, you're starting to see yourself in the mirror, and you're looking better, and you're looking less tired. And then now you're going to get an appropriate amount of sleep. And with the amount of sleep, your stress levels are going to go down. And if your stress levels go down, then you don't worry so much about the past or the future. You stay in the moment. And so all these things work synergistically And I'm actually, as we're having this conversation, Leland, I'm thinking about another book. It's based on literally how you eat is how you do life.
Yeah.
You know, and so anyway, let's think about that as a really poignant last kind of comment.
Yeah, because I can honestly say that in the last 4 years since I've started adopting this lifestyle, I've been more productive, actually 2 years that I've been on it, but I've been more productive in the last 2 years than I've been in my entire life. And it's that clarity of mind, that strength and that confidence that comes from all of that. I do want to talk about your books real quick, but kind of last thing on this, what's the last non-keto or non-paleo thing you ate?
Oh, geez. So I had a house guest. This is going to sound terrible. I had a house guest staying in my place when I was in Thailand for the last 2 weeks. I just got back. And so while I was in Thailand, I had a house guest stay here, and she left some so delicious cashew ice cream, salted caramel. And there were like five spoonfuls left. And rather than throw it out, I sat out on my balcony last night at 11 o'clock at night, and I savored every damn bite. And it was awesome.
You can't let that go to waste.
but that's all I needed. Right. I didn't need to eat a pint of it or a half gallon of it, you know. So anyway, I mean, it's not like I say, it's not like I don't ever eat this stuff. I'm mindful, and at the end of a long day, and by the way, I'd just gotten back from playing frisbee, so I'd exhausted my glycogen reserve, so I could make the argument that, you know, that was appropriate to start to refill some glycogen. At any rate, every once in a while, you know, I'll have a non-keto thing and be proud of it and not feel guilty and not make excuses.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. All right, your books are amazing. I've read The Primal Blueprint and the Keto 21-Day Keto Reset you did, you and Brad Kearns. I'm getting ready to start on Primal Endurance. Where can folks get your information? I know marksdailyapple.com has been a lifesaver for me. It's easy articles. It's linked to science. It's success stories. But your three books are available everywhere. Amazon, Barnes & Noble, right?
Yep. Everywhere.
Awesome.
Yep. Everywhere you can buy a book, you can get them.
And the Keto Reset cookbook also is another thing that I recommend. So check him out. It's marksdailyapple.com. Mark, it was an honor to speak with you. Thanks for what you do, because I think you're changing the world one individual at a time as people begin to pick up on this awesome way of living. So thank you so much.
Appreciate it, Leland, and thanks for telling your friends.
All right. That's the Disruption Zone. We got so much more coming up, so keep checking us out. You can download us on iTunes and on Google Play, and make sure you check it out there and share this episode with your friends.